before the Buddha. It can be very humbling as we set out that first morning with the noblest of intentions to realize the way of all Buddhas, not give rise to a single thought for 7 days, and then find ourselves in the midst of karmic hindrances. So particularly at this time, it's a time to call forth the great practice of patience, deep acceptance and patient endurance of our life. It might not sound like much, patience. It's not really doing anything, right? And yet, when discomfort arises and our deep intention to practice stillness comes up against our thinking mind, patience goes a long way. Patience and renunciation are very similar in this case, particularly around physical discomfort as we sit period after period. Renunciation in the sense of really deeply letting go of our need to, well, our need for comfort. So take care of our body as best we can in such a situation, but surrender, release, let go, renounce, relax into an uncomfortable body. And the more deeply we patiently relax into such a body, the less uncomfortable it actually is, or the situation is, miraculously and counterintuitively. But I think we all know this as sitters. But just to remind us, patience, great patience, and renunciation of a comfortable body. It's not, again, not something we really have to do. We're given an uncomfortable body. But renouncing that wish for a more comfortable one. With the ongoing spirit of great compassion and kindness to ourselves and all beings. And remembering the posture. This is nuts and bolts sesshin, so remembering the details of arranging our legs in a comfortable way that where we can really let them be and don't have to move so much. And the back straight, main thing for the awakeness, for the flow of energy. and concentration and stillness and presence, the spine stays upright. And as gravity pulls us down further and further, sometimes it can feel like climbing a huge mountain to just, in the midst of that, you know, end of a long day of sitting, to just reach the spine upward again. But sometimes that very mountain climb is so exquisitely wonderful. Just that little stretch when I can't, if I move an inch, it will be like thousands of, you know, rocks being hurled at me or something. That's all I can do, to just not move and make it through. At those very times, I don't know if you sometimes have that experience, I can't move, because I'm on the edge of, if I move, I'll have to just stand up. But then at those very times, to actually do it, to actually stretch the spine up, there's a release. Sometimes, maybe this sounds weird, maybe this is a common experience. Sesshin is so much about going beyond what we think is possible for this body and mind. With kindness and with courage and a spirit of adventure, I think Sesshin is really a strange kind of adventure. We've set out on this ship into the midst of the ocean where no land is in sight, and we can't get off. So now we just have whole days to explore this body and mind. It's a very quiet adventure. And to reemphasize that we're doing this for all beings, and to bring up a text that I think we can keep coming back to throughout this sesshin as we study the breath near the beginning here. It's a teaching by the founder of the Chinese Qian Tai school, Juri, who lived about the same time as Bodhidharma. And really a lot of teachings that are like precursor to Chan in China. And this Qian Tai school carried on into Japan and still practiced today in China and Japan. Dogen was ordained as a Tendai monk in Japan. So it's the foundations of his practice too. And Dogen praises Juri in various places as this Chinese founder of Qian Tai. He's sometimes even called a Zen master, even though it's also considered one of the teaching schools outside of Zen. But since Zen can take up anything and use it as skillful means, I bring up this text that you might not have ever heard of, called The Six Dharma Gates to the Sublime, or sometimes translated as The Six Subtle Dharma Gates. And it's Juri's meditation manual on relating to the breath, from just basic counting up to unsurpassed enlightenment. Using Buddha's Indian teachings, but giving a real Mahayana twist, and I think often Zen-like twist, to breath practice. So I want to continue to bring up the teachings of Dogen, Zenji, and the Zen ancestors, nuts and bolts teachings, but here's just a little bit about the spirit of compassion, even when we're counting the breath. Juri says, as for what is referred to as the bodhisattva practice, even at the very time in which one is engaged in the counting of the breaths, one should generate the great vow and abide in compassionate regard for beings. Even though one realizes that beings are ultimately empty of inherent existence, still one wishes to bring beings to perfection and purify the Buddha lands, carrying on with this practice to the very exhaustion of future time. And then he goes on to how bodhisattva practices with the breath. And I think some of these teachings we'll save for future days, but the next section here is still in the counting section. After one has made this compassionate vow, one should immediately and completely understand that those very breaths which are being counted are not produced and not destroyed. Their nature is emptiness and quiescence. Whatsoever is breath is just emptiness. So I'm not going to go into this completely right now. I think we'll hopefully get to it, but just that such a bodhisattva spirit really opening up what breath is can be done while counting the breaths in this case. Juri's six gates, Dharma gates to the sublime, or six subtle Dharma gates, six wonderful Dharma gates, are ways of practicing in relation to the breath. And just to let you know what they are, and we can go through them as they come up. The first one is called counting. So this was what I was encouraging yesterday, that we count breaths in sets of 1 to 10 over and over. The second gate is called following. Following the breath. The third gate is called stopping, which doesn't literally mean stopping the breath, but it's stopping is the Chinese way of translating shamatha, which is calm abiding, and it's somewhat like the experience of the coarse breath is not in the forefront, that sense of stopping, and the discursive, distracted mind comes to rest. Therefore, it's called stopping. So these three together we could call as counting, following, and stopping as on the side of calming meditation, settling meditation, shamatha. The next three Dharma gates, just to list them, are seeing. So the third is stopping, the fourth is seeing. Seeing is, again, the Chinese way of translating vipassana, or insight. But still using the breath as the object of following, counting, following, stopping, seeing. The fifth is turning or returning or turning around. And the sixth is purity. These are the names of these six Dharma gates to the sublime. And it looks like the first three are emphasizing the calming, settling side. The last three are emphasizing the insight, wisdom side. So yesterday I proposed, and as I proposed it and said that I myself would do this practice of counting breaths from 1 to 10 for the rest of the day, which was the practice I took up until just now. So 24 hours of, with some sleep in there, counting breath practice. And I don't know if any of you did that. We can talk about this a little bit today, maybe. I found it very humbling, very challenging. I'm not usually a counter, and very beneficial, I think, too. Humbling in the sense that, well, I think what I proposed was, if we can count 3 rounds of 10 without missing a number, then we could stop counting and just follow. At least that's what I decided for myself. And it's very rare for me to complete 3 rounds of 10. And I was pretty strict with my own standard about this, in the sense that if you're counting and the a little thinking comes up, and there's still kind of the number there, but you can, like, it gets kind of fuzzy though. The number gets kind of fuzzy, and then like on 6, and then like some thought about like a rabbit's hopping or something. I noticed as things went on too, there were not a lot of like long story, obsessive theme park kind of thoughts, that they would like get really random and not so majorly distracting, but enough to like get off the number 6, rabbits hopping, and then like then there's suddenly the mind comes back within like a second or two, and like there's the thought of, oh, this must be the time for 7, even though I don't really remember the 6 because there were some rabbits around it. And so with my practice, I would say, nope, doesn't count, back to 1 at that point. So this is maybe partly why I didn't get very far. But and like I mentioned, it gives us a very direct feedback about where the mind is at. Like the rabbits start hopping at 6, this cycle, and then the next cycle, so if a bigger kind of thought pattern comes up, like around some plan about Sashin or something, then it's really like all over. Then it's really like can't get past 1, and like was, breath. And sometimes it's so much about intention, I feel like, and setting and resetting this motivation or intention. Not just at the beginning of a period, I find, but the beginning of like each cycle of 10. Okay, we're not getting very far, okay. This time, it's like really it's a very intentional mind creation. We're going to count to 10 now. It's a decision, which doesn't always come to fruition, right? But and the way of doing this, I think there's really it can be too heavy-handed, right? It can be like really forceful where we're not relaxed. So this very subtle art of staying really relaxed and flexible and not discouraged, and yet, okay, here we go again. Okay. And despite all the random little thoughts and the difficulty of 1 to 10 over and over, I found, despite myself, despite all the distractions, the overall shape of the mind, something happens there. To do that for a day, there's some settling happening, even though it might not be razor sharp concentration. And I found that often the first day of a sesshin, especially a longer, thinking that we have 7 days, some of us, it's very easy for me to kind of like almost write off the first day, kind of like there's so many days, just I'm just getting used to being here now, this counting practice almost cured that for me. It was maybe one of the more settled first days of a longer sesshin to just not mess around with trying to like decide about any other practice or anything. Just going to do this one thing. Intend to do this one thing all day. So, counting is the first Dharma gate here. And depending on where you're at, and this is completely up to each of us, if we want to move on to the next one, following the breath, this is possible. And even if, you know, it might even be like counting just feels too, we just don't resonate with it. And Juri says this in Places Without. He's like, if you just feel like, you know, counting is too much of a chore, you can get into a kind of chore mind if you're doing it all day, right? And you want to just relax this like number thing, you can just follow the breath. And it might be harder to stay with it, and you might not catch yourself. If you miss one breath when you're following, when the rabbits come by, you might not notice it the same way you would if you're counting. But I think this is very intuitive. Sesshin in general, I think, is a very intuitive and creative thing, very personal. And I'm just offering these different practices, and I think each of us can find our own way. But this is what Juri says here about the sequential development of these six gates. As for the cultivation of counting, the practitioner regulates and harmonizes the breath so that it's neither too rough nor too subtle. One proceeds in an unhurried fashion, slowly counting, going from one on up to ten. One focuses the mind on the counting and does not allow it to run off and become scattered. This is what is meant by the cultivation of counting. So there's each of these six gates has a section called cultivation and realization. So the practice, the cultivation, and then when that practice is realized. As for the realization of counting, the mind imbued with awareness exercises control from one up to ten. Without having to put forth any particular effort, the mind abides in the objective conditions associated with the breath. When one becomes aware that the breath has become insubstantial and faint, the mind becomes gradually more subtle along with it. One subsequently becomes concerned that counting has become a coarse activity. So this is where how one knows that it's time to move on, actually. When one becomes aware that the breath has become insubstantial and faint, I think we all have this experience sitting for a while that the breath gets almost like not much air is actually going in and out. The mind becomes gradually more subtle along with the breath. And then one subsequently becomes concerned that counting has become a coarse activity. One's state of mind is such that one does not wish to engage in counting anymore. At just such time, the practitioner should let loose of the counting and then proceed to cultivate following. So it's almost like an intuitive thing that happens. I think we could still say there's intention behind this, but it's a natural place of like, I think especially if the counting is somewhat successful and you're just counting through and like, this just seems like, I'm just like, these numbers are too gross. And I'm actually not so in touch with the feeling of the breath because I'm so focused on the number. As for the cultivation of following, one relinquishes, lets go of, the previous dharma of counting. One then relies single-mindedly on following the coming in and going out of the breath. One focuses the mind, taking the breath as an object. One becomes aware of the coming in and going out of the breath. The mind abides in the objective conditions associated with the breath, remaining free of any distraction or scattering of one's point of attention. This is what is meant by cultivating following. As for the realization of following, since the mind has become fine and subtle, it becomes peaceful, still, and free of any disorderliness. One becomes aware of the breath as now long, as now short, as now pervading the body, as now coming in, as now going out. The mind and the breath carry on in a state of mutual interdependence. The mind and the breath carry on in a state of mutual interdependence. Our awareness and the breath become more and more one. The deliberations of the mind become tranquil and fixed in a state of stillness. And then this following, which we won't get into today, but also becomes too coarse, which one can proceed to stopping. And so if you're not here for the rest of the days and this is your last day, then you're lucky because you can call it the last day of Sesshin and bring forth the effort that's appropriate for the last day of Sesshin, which is very strong intention because this precious opportunity is quickly dwindling. And you can go on to other practices. Of course, you always can. Regarding this following the breath, I bet most people have heard this one time or another, right? Suzuki Roshi, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. But it's so beautiful, this section on breathing that comes up here. When we practice Zazen, our mind always follows our breathing. And that's already kind of a strong statement, because what about stopping, seeing, returning, and purification, and shikantaza? So I think Suzuki Roshi often talks like this, like, the most important thing is such and such. And then, you know, in another talk, he'd say the most important thing is something else. So he's saying, in this talk, he's saying, when we practice Zazen, our mind always follows our breathing. When we inhale, the air comes into the inner world. When we exhale, the air goes out to the outer world. The inner world is limitless, and the outer world is also limitless. We say inner world or outer world, but actually, there's just one whole world. In this limitless world, our throat is like a swinging door. So when counting or following the breath, this is this vast spirit we can have about these inner and outer limitless worlds and just one complete limitless world while breathing. Especially if our focus starts to get too narrow. We're counting and we're just, it's so, it can get so, it can feel tight and restricted and like we're just here and this one number and we forget the vastness of the world. But particularly letting go of the numbers and just breathing, we can expand the awareness even though it's attending to the movement of the breath, maybe even a particular point in the body. Still, there can be also at the same time, I propose, this larger awareness of the limitless world in which our throat is like a swinging door. The air comes in and goes out like someone passing through a swinging door. If you think I breathe, the I is extra. There is no you to say I. What we call I is just a swinging door which moves when we inhale and when we exhale. It just moves, that's all. When your mind is pure and calm enough to follow this movement, there is nothing. No I, no world, no mind or body, just a swinging door. Very beautiful description of breath meditation that includes everything. Even though our attention is directed towards this movement, this swinging door, it's not me. And that swinging door is happening in the midst of vast, open spaciousness. We also say you can follow the breath through the whole body, but in Zen we often say if you're going to pick a particular point, this tanden, the or Chinese dantian, the which literally means like the elixir field, or the cinnabar field, which is this Taoist term, and Chinese medicine and Taoist energy practices and so on, but this brought into the world of Zen, the elixir field, the magical life-sustaining potion that resides in this field a couple inches below the navel. That point in the body is called the tanden. And it happens to be right where these little fingers meet the body. If the thumbs are like belly button level, which is ideal, belly button level but out a little bit, and then the horizontal palms are resting here, and those little fingers lightly touching the tanden, right at that point, really. That's the point where we can follow the breath, where the fingers touch the body there. There's a little movement, we can feel it going in and out. Now, if you have another breath practice at the nose tip or the whole body or whatever, of course, everything is up to you. But the Dogen's teacher and the Zen tradition have emphasized following the breath at the tanden, or another way, I think that literally the way that Dogen's teacher in China instructed him was place your mind in the palm of your hand, mudra, when you're sitting like this. So not so much like focus your mind on this point, but rest your mind in your hands here, and particularly on the little finger ends of the hands, I would say. But that's the place. And to continue with some nuts and bolts, I've been looking at, maybe we'll continue to look through somewhat there's all these meditation manuals, right, in Zen and Buddhism in general. So this Six Subtle Gates of Juri is a technique-oriented meditation manual, and Zen has many of these too. Well, the Fukan Zazengi is Dogen's classic meditation manual, giving the instructions, the nuts and bolts practice. And we have another that gets even more detailed a couple of generations later, Keizan Zenji, who basically honors Dogen's instructions and just elaborates on them further. So this is called the Zazen Yojinki, which is means something like how to use the mind in Zazen. And it's much longer than the Fukan Zazengi, but it's early Soto Zen meditation manual, to the point of like what you should do when you're not in meditation, and a lot about kinhin, and even like what to eat and things like this. So he gets very detailed. Woven in is a lot of ultimate Zen inspiration as well. But a little about the breath, because he does, Dogen very rarely talks about the breath, but Keizan does. Talks about harmonizing the breath, which is, I think some of these teachings are coming from Juri and Tiantai, where they talk about harmonizing the breath and other meditation practices. When sitting in meditation, zazen, your body may seem hot or cold, uneasy or comfortable, sometimes stiff, sometimes loose, sometimes heavy, sometimes light, sometimes startled awake, all these physical experiences. This is all because the breath is not in tune and needs to be tuned. The way of tuning the breath is as follows. Open your mouth, letting the breath be long or short, gradually harmonizing it, following it for a while. When a sense of awareness comes, the breath is then in good tune. After that, let the breath pass naturally through the nose. The mind may seem to sink away or float off. Sometimes it seems dull, sometimes sharp. And various extraordinary experiences that you might have are all diseases from lack of harmony between awareness and breath. When they happen, sit with the mind resting in the lap or on the feet if they're crossed like this. And now there's a discussion about distraction, like restless mind and sleepy mind, the two extremes that disturb our concentration. It's going to bring up all five hindrances, the five hindrances to meditation, but maybe we'll focus on these two, the five hindrances being sense desire, which I think as we sit, I guess we could say wanting to move is the basic sense desire, the desire for a more comfortable physical sensation of the body. But we also might get hungry or whatever, but that might not be the dominant one. And also ill will or anger or resistance, of course these things can come up during zazen. These are grosser ones, the sense desire and the ill will. Those we just letting go. But then the next pair, is this restlessness or agitation and worry mind, just stuff coming up. And then the other more extreme is dullness and lazy mind and just haziness. Overly excited and overly depressed and sleepy. And the fifth hindrance is doubt about what the practice is. But to emphasize these two, which are often brought up in these meditation manuals of distraction, restlessness, and then sloth and torpor, sometimes also called. And I think this experience of like following the breath and feeling like not so sleepy and not so agitated and like the image of just like, you know, ants or rabbits or something, or just random stuff just popping into the mind. I was trying to discern which of these two. I think, you know, if it has to fall, if every distraction to meditation has to fall into one of these five hindrances, which I think sometimes proposed that way, when all these five hindrances are like settled, then the mind is totally concentrated. I think there, you know, it might even alternate between this restlessness, just maybe the mind is a little bit bored with the breath and just wants to bring in some rabbits. And it could also, I think sometimes a very, not really sleepy, but just a kind of dullness that gets into that unresistible daydreaming. Like when we're just starting to fall asleep, we can't stop the just like flow of just weird random thoughts sometimes. So it might even alternate between these two. Even within a few seconds between restlessness and sleepiness, if they're very subtle, I think this is possible. But in general, the instructions here are if the mind sinks into torpor, the dullness and sleepiness, rest your mind between your eyes on your hairline, 3 inches above the center of the eyebrows. So like, like third eye place maybe, or maybe it's a little higher. Basically raise your attention from down here to up here. Place your mind's attention. It's amazing we can do that now. We can place our attention in different places of the body. And that has an effect. And I have found over the years that, well, I don't know why these things work, but I think there really is something to these. Another one they say is, if we generally look 45 degrees down, the eyes open a little bit. If we're in the dullness place, raise the gaze upward a little bit on the wall. And I think it's the same idea as moving the attention from here up to here. And it's easy to remember because this, you know, the dullness thing is like we're sinking into oblivion. So raising the energy, intentionally moving the attention upwards here, or raising the gaze. You can try it out if you feel sleepy. If you're really sleepy, I think these things maybe don't work. So they're kind of subtle energy techniques. If your mind is distracted and scattered, rest your mind on the tip of your nose, maybe surprising, and the tanden, 1.5 inches below the navel. Ordinarily when sitting, when you're not distracted or torporous, then rest the mind in the left palm, that's Tendo Nyojo's instruction, which is a lot like the Tanden. So maybe the way of sitting all the time is generally to put to rest the scattered, distracted mind. When you sit for a long time, though you do not force the mind to be calm, it will naturally not be scattered. If torpor and sleepiness overcomes you while sitting, always move your body or open your eyes wide. You know, we say you might not want to move too much, right? But that would be a case where you could, while you're sitting, often when it's torpor, the body starts getting like this, right? So move your body might just be like, without disturbing anyone, just really sit upright. I find this great medicine for torporous, and eyes open. So we say always leave eyes open, but you can open them even wider if you're feeling dull. And then, you know, there's things to do if you're kind of sitting on your own. Basically, you get up and do kinhin is the instruction. And I think if people really feel like they're completely falling asleep here, I think we could say it's okay to get up and do quiet kinhin if you'd like. And then, you know, during the kinhin break, washing your eyes and face with cold water, reciting the preface to the Bodhisattva precepts or some such thing. Just find some way not to fall asleep. So you can really get, like, if nothing works, just start reciting some sutra that you memorized even, or something like this. You should observe that the matter of life and death is a great one and impermanence is swift. What are you doing sleeping when your eye of the way is not yet clear? If torpor and drowsiness come over you repeatedly, you can pray, "My habits are deep-seated and that's why I'm shrouded by drowsiness. When will my torpor disperse? I pray that the Buddhas and ancestors will be compassionate and remove my darkness and misery." Now, this is kind of drastic measures maybe, but maybe necessary sometime. Likewise, if your mind is scattered, lower belly, count your breaths, he says actually. It's in our early Soto Zen instructions. Count the incoming, outgoing breaths. If that doesn't stop your distraction, then bring a saying to mind and keep it in mind. For example, and these koans are mentioned, what is it that thus comes? A dog has no Buddha nature. When no thought arises, is there any fault? Mount Sumeru. So these are like some of these classic, very ordinary kind of koans. What is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West? The cypress tree in the garden. Flavorless sayings like this are suitable. In other words, don't get into like some really complicated koan story. Really simple, straightforward. If scattering distraction still doesn't stop, sit and focus on the point where the breath ends and the eyes close forever. Is death? Or else where the embryo is not yet conceived and not a single thought is produced. When emptiness suddenly appears, the scattered mind will surely come to rest. And then Keizan says, when coming out of stillness, when you carry on your activities of the day without thinking, the genjo is the koan. So he's constantly referencing Dogen here. But the manifestation of your activity is the fundamental point. When you accomplish practice and verification without interfusion, then the fundamental point is the manifestation. The koan is the genjo. That which is before any signs appear, the situation on the other side of the empty eon, the spiritual capacity of all Buddhas and ancestors is just this one thing. Just rest, cease, be cool, passing myriad years as an instant, be cold ashes, a dead tree, an incense burner in an ancient shrine, a piece of white silk, this I pray. That's how he ends his instructions. And do you have anything to bring up about clarifying on any of these teachings? Yes.
I took your admonition yesterday to count.
Mm.
It was very difficult to get beyond five before I was going to the future. I was taking responsibilities. On and on. But some of the things that you mentioned today, I was actually doing, for instance, opening your eyes when you started really getting sleepy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, straightening your back and forcing your eyes really open makes a nice shift.
Yeah.
And even though it may not be very permanent,
nothing is.
It was helpful.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'd be really interested in hearing more about Kinhin.
Kinhin is also a time to where you can count breath, and I found through the day yesterday it's easier to count to 10 at Kinhin. I think because of the movement, you're already, the walking is synchronized with the breath. And again, usually I don't count during Kinhin, but I was yesterday, and I found it much easier than sitting, actually. And I think that's because there's a little more movement, the breath can get so subtle and we get so still, so that little bit of activity is sometimes more concentrating, for some people anyway. And in general, Kinhin is the upper body's like Zazen, like you can really stand very upright, and I noticed the difference too of like the shashu. We can have a shashu where it's kind of low and our elbows are kind of resting on our body and it's more comfortable maybe. But I find this raising up the shashu. I think some instructions even say keeping your arms horizontal, and you may have seen people sometimes, maybe this more Rinzai practice, really like this kind of, you know, which I think is maybe too much. I think in our way we say it's too contrived. We should be more natural, but something in between. I noticed lifting the elbows off the body. It takes more energy, but it lifts the back up too, and has a different feeling. You can be gliding along in such a way. That's one little Kenyan detail. The whole upper body and head. And I think one instruction says, you know, don't look at your feet during Kenyan. So like keep your head up and your eyes angled down. Any other experiences with counting or anything else? Yeah. Breath is a long time. Just keep the number going, which is still a pretty concentrated activity to not lose the number, to be able to add in some extra stuff and know it is, you could even say, is more concentrated in a way. And it's all just conditions give rise to that stuff. You know, strictly speaking, we would say none of it's actually really random. You know, just what seemingly random images are like, you know, just conditioned images that the mind is, due to some completely unknown conditions, is getting stirred up at that particular time. And then sometimes we see a particular thing really disturbs us and we get some obsessional mind track. But, yeah, it's like we're not in control of what comes up. And I really appreciated your point too, which is, I think, an important experiential thing that you might not find in these kind of manuals of when we're actually kind of sleepy or dull. It might, you know, probably the manuals would say, well, don't relax. That's the time to bring forth more effort. But my experience is similar, that sometimes relaxing even more when you're sleepy brings you out of it. And I think this may be because sometimes that sleepiness, it's not physical sleepiness necessarily, it's like resistance to like be trying too hard. Like, this is so difficult and I'm making so much effort and the mind just starts shutting down. Like, I just, you know, it's its own way of resisting despite ourselves, like, I'm not going to do this. It's like the rebellious unconscious starts getting dull. And I think at those times to actually relax, stop effort, and there were times when I, you know, stop counting, and then it's actually more concentrated. So I think this is where it gets really creative and intuitive for each of us. Yeah. It seems like it's becoming too coarse. Also get there's another extreme too from that force thing of getting kind of like, well, I'm just like just trying to make it through the day, it's enough work already. I think we can get into a kind of lazy attitude sometimes too. So I think what you're talking about is that middle way that's just like it can become more and more effortless, dynamic stillness. And yeah, creatively and intuitively continuing. Yes?
I've sort of gotten into the trap of counting over the last 4 or 5 years where at some point I was, you know, making my legs and I thought, well, if I can make it through 10 groups of 10, then I'll move my life. Then I discovered that this leg falls asleep from about here to here at about 10 groups of 10 before the end of a 40-minute sit. So now as soon as the leg falls asleep, I tend to start doing this time to the end of the sit. And sometimes it works fine.
You start doing what?
Pardon?
What do you start doing it when it falls asleep?
I'll know that in 10 groups, ten breaths, it's pretty regular that the session will end. And so, you know, it's kind of like watching your your watch and counting your breaths.
Yeah.
And sometimes it still works, and you know, I open up, and it's fine, and other times I'm simply, you know, like I said, other times it degenerates into almost watching a watch.
Yeah, I think if you're doing it, or any practice with some expectation, then it's going to be problematic. But if you can just do that as a way to be focused, but then if you get past that number, then just keep going and just like without any idea the period will ever end, then we're just present.
So just try to work on one door of each group of 10.
Yeah, you don't even really need to count how many there are either, you know. Because it doesn't really matter, except that that's more of like a concentration, I guess, if you're keeping track in that way. But yeah, none of it's like to get to any particular number or anything. It's just all about being present. It's just that the breath is happening now and it's just returning to the present. And it's important to remember that this is at the beginning, we're talking about this practice, and it's more than just being present, this practice. And I think we know that this is all within this larger context, but right now we're just emphasizing the nuts and bolts of breath, counting and following. And we can see how that evolves into other practices. Also, I thought for this session where we're really focusing on meditation techniques and talking about that more specifically, I thought that for Gokusan, which maybe we want, if there's people who are like leaving today and want to come meet to talk about practice, we might have that today. For people who are staying through, we'll maybe wait a few more days. But at that time, to not have it just be the kind of regular way we do it is just anything goes and you can talk as long as you want and bring up anything about your life, but to keep it really kind of short and focused on particulars of Zazen practice or what's happening, you know, in the Dokusan room in that very moment. I think these two ways. So I think it's good to have room for discussing practice in the larger context outside of Sesshin, because we have all kinds. It's great to talk with practitioners about what's going on in our life and process things. But in this kind of retreat, let's try this way where, you know, we could even say, you know, 10 minutes or less, and on specifics of meditation practice or, you know, walking practice, or, you know, some like physical practice in the day, or we can also open it up to, you know, this is not about my Zazen last period, but like right now I feel, you know, anxious or something. Because in a way, Dokusan is like a period of Zazen with words to it. So treating it that way. So we carry on with counting, following, or stopping, or whatever our practice is in this larger context of the boundless world where the breath is just this swinging door in the middle. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. Buddha's ways unsurpassable, I vow to become